This is the Emergency Medicine Literature of Note audio digest for the month of November 2016. This is just an audio review of some of the articles that I posted on my blog over the past month, and we'll just get right into it. So the first one is titled Safety of Lumbar Puncture in Comatose Children with Clinical Features of Cerebral Malaria, and this is from the Journal of Neurology. And this was a pretty simple sort of retrospective look with some propensity matching at children from sub-Saharan Africa who were comatose from malaria and undergoing lumbar puncture for diagnosis of cerebral malaria, and then following along to see what their ultimate mortality was, and then also whether they had complications such as herniation. This is supposed to sort of vaguely tie into that concept of whether you need a CT before an LP that's basically based on this, you know, observational data from 50 plus years ago where a bunch of people who got LPs because they had meningitis ultimately went on and herniated and died. Was it the LP that caused the herniation? Most people have probably concluded by now that CT is unnecessary before LP, except in a handful of situations, but this is more another piece of evidence saying that you probably don't need a CT before LP in virtually any situation, and that even the mass effect or the increased intracranial pressure that you see probably isn't going to cause herniation just based on the couple cc's of cerebral spinal fluid that you're pulling out from the lumbar spine. The authors at the very end say, in a stable patient without localizing neurologic signs, it is entirely reasonable to perform a lumbar puncture without a CT scan. The next article is called Costs and Consequences Associated with Misdiagnosed Lower Extremity Cellulitis, and this comes out of the JAMA Dermatology issue. And this is a funny article because it kind of starts with a simple observation by a family of dermatologists looking at the misdiagnosis rate for lower extremity cellulitis in a hospitalized population. And then it just goes on and on and on to sort of produce these outrageous statistics about how much money we're losing. This is a retrospective evaluation of 259 patients hospitalized over a two-year period. The dermatologists basically went through every chart, looked at the documentation, and then made a conclusion one way or the other whether the patient actually had cellulitis or whether it was a misdiagnosis. They concluded, based on their retrospective evaluation of the charts, that about 30% of the patients who had a hospitalization and suspected cellulitis of their lower extremities were misdiagnosed. The authors then plug these numbers into their cost calculations for unnecessary care and conclude that every year there are 130,000 unnecessary hospitalizations for lower extremity cellulitis, costing $515 million. So, this got a lot of play in the news media because, of course, you know, we're misdiagnosing cellulitis one-third of the time. But, you know, based on a shadowy chart review with omissions and inaccuracies, compounded by the sort of complicated medical presentations common at a teaching facility and referral population, whether that's generalizable to all of the people hospitalized with cellulitis in all the community hospitals around the world is another thing entirely. Then, even their cost numbers are probably inflated, saying the average cost of a quote-unquote unnecessary hospitalization is $12,600, which means they're generalizing hospitalizations for all manner of things, not just misdiagnosed cellulitis, to their cost calculations and coming up with this insane number of $500 million a year. So, you know, if you have patients who are sufficiently ill and have lots of comorbidities and they have something that looks like cellulitis, you're probably going to end up treating it. How many of these patients were being hospitalized primarily for their cellulitis? It's not clear because, again, it's retrospective. How many of these patients were actually just being covered for cellulitis to be on the safe side? You know, there are many, many problems with overdiagnosis and overtreatment for sure. And there's probably a way to be better at diagnosing lower extremity cellulitis. And these dermatologists, luckily enough, have the solution. They think that a dermatologist should be involved in every single admission to the hospital for cellulitis to make the definitive diagnosis to be the gold standard. And I look forward to seeing that. The next article is called Analysis of Machine Learning Techniques for Heart Failure Readmissions. And this is from Circulation Outcomes Research in the American Heart Association. This paper falls into that sort of realm of big data, precision medicine, predictive analytics, all the different sorts of buzzwords out there. But what it basically ends up meaning is it's machine learning versus logistic regression. Logistic regression being a traditional statistical analysis where everything kind of gets placed on a sort of predictive line, and you sort of add all these lines together to be a multivariate sort of equation, and you can sort of try and predict heart failure readmission. In machine learning methods, you end up with random forests and different sorts of predictive models where you're just sorting things in different buckets. A little more complicated, the main advantage is that it handles a bunch of different types of data in a more graceful fashion. Things with ordinal and nominal and categorical data, and can supply sort of non-linear relationships between different features. And it's pretty easy to make a predictive model that incorporates lots and lots and lots of different features in a way that multivariate and logistic regression just doesn't handle very well. So it's a pretty simple article. In the end, they just basically sum up their different statistical methods, compare them. The logistic regression models had a C statistic of 0.533 for predicting heart failure readmission. And as you know from C statistics, that's basically a coin flip, no predictive skill essentially. The random forest model was their best model, and it achieved a C statistic of 0.628. How do these actually perform compared to, say, clinician gestalts? Can you look at a patient and sort of synthesize it as a clinician using information that's not available to the computer to predict better than the C statistic of 0.628? Maybe. They don't really have a comparison. 0.628 is still essentially clinically unusable, even if it's a little bit better than a coin flip. But if you're trying to, decide choose patients for follow-up interventions, you're probably going to want to tune a model and a different weighting system to try and maximize specificity if you're going to invest money in trying to prevent patients from being readmitted. And then, of course, the main problem is, can you actually prevent them from being readmitted with your interventions? And this next article was Endovascular Treatment for Patients with Acute Stroke Who Have a Large Ischemic Core and Large Mismatch Imaging Profile. And this is from the Journal of Stroke and the American Heart Association. So we're all pretty familiar with the endovascular therapy for acute stroke these days, and you're probably seeing it used in a whole bunch of different clinical situations. The trials, the best trials, the ones that I believe in the most, are the ones that used imaging criteria to find the ones that had collateral circulation with a viable perfusion sort of penumbra versus a really small area of irreversible dead brain. These are the ones targeted by, say, Extend-IA, Escape, Swift Prime, the ones with a really, really small infarct core surrounded by a potentially viable tissue. And, the outcomes with endovascular intervention are much, much better than, probably placebo and probably with tPA as well, because tPA just doesn't work on large clots. We're talking like less than 5% of the time does it even break up the clot. So forget it if you're talking about tPA and a large vessel occlusion. Anyway, so these authors basically offer this observational series saying, well, we took, of course we had FDA approved and got the indications to go ahead and get into the guidelines to have endovascular therapy, and now of course we're just using it for all sorts of stuff, and because we think it might be good. And again, they think it might be good, even if your infarct core is a little bit larger than tiny. So we're still talking pretty small infarct cores, somewhere between 50 mLs and 100 mLs. And they have 56 patients in their retrospective case control comparison, and they're missing long-term follow-up for 9 of them. And, well, hey, they're a little bit better in the endovascular group. This is the sort of data that's not reliable or generalizable for anything other than to say, hey, it might be, you're right, it might be helpful. I tend to believe that they're probably correct, but I think I'm hoping we'll see more prospective evaluation of whether it's actually valuable in larger infarct cores as well. This next little article is Effectiveness of Reduction Maneuvers in the Treatment of Nursemaid's Elbow, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis, and this is from the American Journal of Emergency Medicine. There are basically two ways to treat a nursemaid's elbow. One is supination inflection, and that's probably the one we probably saw the most of growing up. And then the other one is hyperpronation, which is really kind of just a quick flick of the wrist, and I like it better. And so I went and found an article that supported my standpoint. It is actually this little systematic review of meta-analysis, and it looks at the success rates, and it says the pooled failure rate with supination flexion is 27% failure rate, and then the pooled failure rate with hyperpronation was 9.1%. I tend to like hyperpronation because it doesn't frighten the children quite as much. You're not grabbing the hand and manipulating it for quite as long as you are with hyperpronation. So hyperpronation is much faster, whereas supination is really just you have to wrench it, and there's a lot of opportunity for them to provide some resistance. You have to turn the whole wrist over and then flex it against their sort of, they're all tensed up and they're crying and they're screaming, whereas hyperpronation, you can almost just surprise them. You know, they're holding their arms sort of still. They don't want anybody to touch it. And certainly if you start manipulating it, they get really upset really fast. So the quicker you can manipulate it, the better. And of course, it doesn't hurt that it has a better success rate as well. This next article is called Effect of Evolocumab on Progression of Coronary Disease in Statin-Treated Patients, the Glagov Randomized Clinical Trial. This has not a whole lot of relevance to emergency medicine, but it's one of those things where the article is just so bad I had to talk about it. So, you know, everybody takes a statin if you have elevated cholesterol, and it's supposed to, as we well know, the number needed to treat is enormous. If you don't have known coronary disease or if you haven't had a heart attack, the number needed to treat is, you know, in the thousands to try and prevent some sort of adverse outcome at, you know, 2-5 years. So there's a lot of debate on whether people taking statins should even be on their statins. And so this next drug, evolocumab, Repatha, is one of the, we'll call it, so the pro-protein convertase subtilisin cachexin type 9 inhibitors, PCSK9 inhibitors. This trial, basically, new PCSK9 inhibitor to a statin, compared it with patients just on a statin, and their primary outcome was the nominal change in percent coronary atheroma volume at 78 weeks as measured by an endovascular ultrasound. And so the trial favors evolocumab, of course, which is why it ends up in, you know, JAMA. But the difference is in the statin-treated patients, they have basically a 0.05% increase in their coronary atheroma volume. And when you add the $14,000 a dose drug, it's taken by a subcutaneous injection twice a year. When you add this $14,000 drug to it, you get a 0.95% decrease in coronary atheroma volume. And, well, this is our next medical miracle. There were, of course, no signals of clinically relevant benefits in this trial of 968 patients, and luckily there weren't any obvious harms, but yet again, I can't really see how this is going to end up being generalizably useful. Certainly not at the current costs. It does a really good job of lowering LDL levels, though. You know, again, this is the LDL surrogate that we've been working with for decades. This next article is called Disease Course of Lower Respiratory Tract Infections with a Bacterial Cause, and it's in the Annals of Family Medicine. This is kind of an interesting study in the sense that it ties into this idea that, well, you know, humans have been on the earth for millions of years, and bacteria did manage to kill us off before then, you know, so why do we need so many antibiotics for every friggin' thing now? So this is a sub-study of the GRACE-10 study, which involved primary care patients with acute cough. And the GRACE-10 study was basically randomizing patients to antibiotics for their acute cough or nothing for their acute cough, and just following them and seeing, you know, the natural course of disease versus, you know, cough versus not. And so this sub-study looks at which patients actually had a potentially bacterial cause for their lower respiratory infection, because they all had, you know, blood cultures and antibody titers and respiratory cultures and nasal swabs, you know, looking for the atypical pathogens, looking for strep and that sort of thing. And basically they find there's 162 patients who they thought had a bacterial pathogen based on the respiratory culture, the nasal swab, and the antibody titers. It was mostly strep pneumonia and Haemophilus influenzae, and they have also the atypicals, the chlamydias, the mycoplasmas, etc. And at the end of the day, whether you're on antibiotics or not, despite in this little cohort that had bacterial infection suspected, they almost always did fine. The patients with the confirmed bacterial pathogen got better a little bit more slowly than those without. They had a little greater in terms of revisits in follow-up due to worsening or new symptoms. And a greater percentage of these patients were either placed on or had, you know, antibiotics in follow-up, like 12% basically in their revisit ended up getting placed on antibiotics, whereas 6% of the people already on antibiotics had their antibiotics changed. So there's a, you know, sort of a treatment, quote-unquote treatment failure sort of initial thing. But that's still just, you know, that means 88% of these patients with a lower respiratory tract infection with a presumed bacterial source got better. And that's kind of how mammals and the rest of us have all evolved. If we get a bacterial infection, we have this thing called the immune system to fight it off. So, you know, seeking out and treating not just like the suspected infections, but actually the real infections, you know, our threshold for treatment really needs to be a lot higher. So anyways, my thought at the end of this was, well, we do otitis media with sort of a delayed antibiotic strategy. It's probably viral, but, you know, if it doesn't get better in a few days, maybe there's a bacterial overgrowth and, you know, really need something. Maybe we could do the same thing for lower respiratory infections. You know, you say you don't need anything today, even though I think you have a bacterial infection or you have an opacity on x-ray. It could be viral still. Why don't you just keep an eye on it? If you're not feeling better in a few days, then maybe you can start antibiotics and see if there's a, you know, secondary source that we need to eradicate as well. The next article is Predicting Flow in the Pediatric Emergency Department: Are Holidays Lighter? And this comes from the Pediatric Emergency Care Journal. And it's really just a quick article that I threw up here before I worked my string of holiday shifts, because I was looking up to see what is it in general should I be expecting on my shift tomorrow. And the answer is it should be lighter. And I will tell you that my Thanksgiving was not specifically lighter than it usually is. Some people, some shifts, I think, in the morning had a good day, but my 6 p.m. to 3 a.m. swing shift was no lighter. And I think that, you know, this is pediatric data from a single center, and whether it's generalizable or not, the holidays anyways that are supposed to be lighter, and specifically the shifts that should be the lightest, are going to be Christmas morning and Thanksgiving morning. In their little analysis, the ones that didn't reach statistical significance, but they probably are a little bit lighter once you've had, you know, if you had a greater number of patients in this review. Martin Luther King Day and Labor Day could be a little bit lighter. Again, the morning shifts specifically. And then Washington's birthday, Memorial Day, Columbus Day, New Year's Day didn't seem to be any lighter than the average holiday. Another article here. This is anticoagulant therapy for symptomatic calf deep vein thrombosis, CACTUS, a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. And this is from the Lancet Hematology. And so this is all about calf clots, and we've all been sort of traditionally been taught that you know, deep venous thrombosis, but more proximally, is the really important occlusion to find. But there is still some risk of progression from calf clots, and we still haven't figured out the balance of risks and benefits, and, you know, whether you don't need anything, or whether you could use an antiplatelet, or whether you could use, you know, Coumadin, or now that we have things that are different than Coumadin, the direct-acting oral anticoagulants. And this CACTUS trial basically just gives me an opportunity to say one more time that we still don't know for sure. But it did give me an opportunity to talk to the great Tom DeLory up at Oregon Health and Science University and to hook this in with Jeff Klein. And they both believe that the direct-acting oral anticoagulants, specifically for deep calf clots, probably should be prescribed for probably about a month to 6 weeks. And the more superficial calf clots, there, it's a little bit less clear exactly what to do with those, whether you can just treat with NSAIDs or aspirin or another antiplatelet. But the consensus tends to be, at least as far as direct-acting oral anticoagulation being more convenient and a little bit better safety profile suspected anyways, and the real threat of venous thromboembolism from these calf clots, to go ahead and treat with a shorter course. I think Jeff Klein chimed in on Twitter to mention that he gets a repeat ultrasound in a couple weeks to sort of assess what's going on, to sort of help guide the duration of therapy. And lastly, this last article is Persistent Pain After Motor Vehicle Collision: Comparative Effectiveness of Opioids Versus Non-Steroidal Anti-Inflammatory Drugs Prescribed from the Emergency Department, a Propensity Matched Analysis. So it is way cheaper and way easier to do a retrospective propensity-based analysis of something than to actually go ahead and do a prospective trial. If you have a nice data set, whether it's from an electronic data set or from a registry, some other prospectively collected data set, it is way easier to just data mine it for associations. And that's what they've done here. Even though it gets covered in the lay press as, you know, opiates aren't as good as NSAIDs, and there's no reason to give opiates for motor vehicle collision pain. That's not really what this says, and it's really not what it should be generalized to say. So this is, you know, there's 800 odd people in this registry that they have access to that's prospectively collected information on how people feel after their car accident, whether they get prescriptions, and there's like follow-up at like 6 weeks and follow-up beyond that even. But their primary outcome was the amount of continued musculoskeletal pain at 6 weeks of moderate or severe levels. And they then break it down between people receiving a prescription for opiates and a prescription for NSAIDs. And obviously, people who get opiate prescriptions after their car accidents are probably being prescribed opiates because they have more serious injuries, more serious injury mechanism, lacerations, they say small phalanx fractures, that sort of thing. And then when they go through their little, you know, limitations section, they mention that there's definitely a difference in severity of pain and severity of injury to the patients who received opiates versus NSAIDs. And that's where they say their propensity scoring comes in. But to have propensity scoring really work, one, you need a whole bunch of patients, and really you need a whole bunch of robust features. And they really don't have enough features to really make sure all their confounders are matched between the two groups. And even then, you just still worry about systematic bias based on the sort of the treatment cohort selection. So, and it's only like 284 patients in their little cohort, which means they're committing type 2 error. If they don't find a difference between the two groups because their sample is so underpowered, that doesn't mean that there isn't a difference. It just means their sample's underpowered. And they don't find a difference between their two groups in this self-reported pain because the confidence intervals are so wide, they obviously overlap. And so, you know, they also have to impute a bunch of missing data. And then, you know, the primary outcomes are 6 week musculoskeletal pain. You know, that doesn't say that there's not some benefit to the opiates in that intervening week, short term severe pain or return to work or quality of life. It just means that, you know, some people are still sore 6 weeks later. And I don't know how they could say that, you know, opiates are somehow ineffective or unwarranted. I'm all about responsible prescribing of opioids and avoiding them whenever possible. But this is perpetuating that narrative without actually being reliable evidence to back it up. So that's the summary of all of my blog posts for the month of November. December might be kind of a short month. I'm expecting a baby any time now, so there may be a few articles. There may be a lot of articles. We'll see how much free time we end up having. But it could be a little busy around the Radecki household. Thank you for listening. I'm glad you stuck with me in my second episode here. I'll just keep on tracking and looking for feedback, and if things are going well, this will just keep being a regular occurrence. You can also catch me reviewing the articles from Annals of Emergency Medicine with Roy Spiegel on that podcast, and of course you can find me on Twitter at emlitofnote. Take it easy.